This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and you can call me Kareem, please.
I was hoping you'd say you can identify me as a writer and activist who once played some basketball.
That's too long.
Too long, maybe, but not wrong. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the NBA's all-time leading scorer, has written over a dozen books, history, social commentary, kids' books, autobiography, and he's only 70. Anyway, I had the opportunity to talk with Kareem recently, and one of the things on his mind was his relationship with celebrated college basketball coach John Wooden, who recruited Kareem to UCLA in 1965 when Kareem was still Lou Alcindor.
For me, it was an insight into what Mr. Wooden was all about when I first met him, because we started talking and we immediately got off the subject of basketball. And he said, you know, I noticed that you have good grades and UCLA is an excellent school. I expect you to do well here. And, I was kind of surprised. You know, most basketball coaches don't care about that. And, I understood immediately that we were simpatico that way. I was at UCLA to get an education, and we struck it off right away in terms of vision and appreciation of each other's goals.
Still, on the surface, the young, gangly 7'2 center and his middle-aged coach couldn't have been less alike. Kareem, black and New York. Wooden, white and Indiana. And it didn't take long for Kareem to begin to understand how their different backgrounds would determine how they handled circumstances they encountered together. Take, for example, a meal they shared at a sports bar during Kareem's recruiting visit.
Well, we went to the Bat Rack and had dinner. Coach Wooden was getting to know me, and a woman, a very elderly white woman, approached Coach Wooden. I was standing right near him, and she asked him some questions about me and wanted to know how tall I was. And then she used the N-word in saying that she'd never seen anybody that tall.
It wasn't how the dinner was supposed to have gone, but even at 18, Kareem was not naive.
You know, I had been through that before. It was nothing new to me. So, you know, I dealt with it, but Coach Wooden was flabbergasted. He was stunned. He didn't know how to reply. She walked off and to her it was just her feeling out her curiosity about my height.
It seems to me that he might have been stuck. I mean, obviously he doesn't want to just let this slide, but also he doesn't want to insult an elderly woman, I guess.
Right. You didn't expect to hear that from someone like that. It reminds me of, did you see the movie Blazing Saddles?
I did indeed.
Yeah, when Cleavon Little is talking to the lady had the pies, and she uses the N-word like that.
Good evening, Sheriff. Sorry about the up yours. I hope this apple pile in some small way say thank you for your ingenuity and courage in defeating that horrible Mongol.
Well, thank you. Much obliged. Good night.
It's kind of the same thing, you know?
Thus began this development of a lasting friendship between a coach who didn't know what to do when an old lady referred to his player and dinner guest with a racial slur, and a player who could appreciate and empathize with his coach's discomfort. John Wooden was in his mid-50s when he recruited the 18-year-old Kareem. I was beginning to understand how the older man, who was supposed to be the teacher, learned from the younger one, which was part of what Kareem had on his mind when we spoke. Because in 1966, when Kareem, still known as Lou Alcindor, began carrying the UCLA basketball program to heights previously unimagined, John Wooden found himself in a position he'd never experienced.
I think I took some of the fun out of it for him. Because prior to me coming to UCLA, UCLA were, the first year they won the NCAA tournament, they were underdogs. And then the second year, everybody was, like, excited to see them repeat. And then here I come along, and the three NCAA tournaments that I played in were the first three of seven in a row. And people got sick of UCLA at that point. And then instead of playing to win, coach had to coach in a way to not to lose.
Then in the final 20 minutes, the UCLA blitz begins. And as usual, Lou Alcindor is the center of attraction.
it's tough being number one. It's tough to stay up there and maintain that excellence and try to extend your ability to dominate.
So there was pressure, even with the best player in the country piling up points, while UCLA overwhelmed opponents by scores like 116-78 and 122-57. But Kareem also recalls that during those days, for the players and their coach, there was time for learning. Yeah, that word again. Sometimes during games, and on one especially memorable occasion in early December 1968, after they'd put another win in the books.
Well, we were on a bus trip going between games that we had to play in the Midwest. We were driving from Columbus to Notre Dame. And we just kind of like backed into a conversation, me and some of the guys, about our various religious beliefs. And we had a pretty varied group of guys. We had two Jewish guys on the team and a couple guys in a fellowship of Christian athletes. And then I had converted to Islam, but I hadn't told anybody about it. And I started to talk about my religious beliefs. And we kind of got to the point where we started to listen to each other. You know, we didn't try to dominate the conversation with proselytizing and demanding that everybody see it the way that one or the other of us wanted to see it. It was a nice experience. Coach Wooden kind of came and stood on the periphery and listened and kind of edged us on in order to give everybody the opportunity to speak and really brought us close together.
Did that ever happen again?
No, I don't think it did, because, you know, the time and quiet and, you know, just no interference. Good ride, you know.
So there was all that winning. UCLA won 88 regular season games and lost just two while Kareem was there. And there was learning, but it wasn't all sweetness and light. Some of Kareem's teammates took issue with John Wooden's rules, which they felt were arbitrary. It was the 60s, after all. One Wooden mandate, short hair, allegedly because the coach thought otherwise his players might leave the gym after showering with wet hair and get colds. But Kareem was able to see beyond Wooden's rules and motivational sayings to the coach's deeper purpose.
He didn't see himself as someone who dehumanized the people that he had to work with in terms of coaching them. How did Coach describe it? He said, a coach is someone who can criticize without creating resentment.
You're laughing. It sounds like maybe it didn't always work.
No, it did. He knew how to do it.
And sometimes Coach Wooden surprised Kareem with how well he knew how to do it. In 1968, Kareem was urged to join the U.S. team that would be competing at the Olympics in Mexico City. As a patriot, Coach Wooden expected no less. Kareem was not receptive.
For me, that was an especially sore issue. Dr. King had just been assassinated. I wasn't feeling very patriotic. But what really affected me was the fact that I was going to have to work with Avery Brundage. Avery Brundage is the individual who told the Jewish players on the 1936 Olympic team that they couldn't compete because it would annoy Mr. Hitler. And, you know, he was still the chairman of the Olympic Committee, and I wasn't going to do anything with him. So for me, it was an easy decision.
An easy decision that Kareem thought might cause a rupture in his relationship with Coach Wooden, but Wooden never mentioned it. And then many years later, Kareem learned that John Wooden had recalled and processed the lessons he'd begun learning at that dinner at the bat rack.
Yes, John Wooden received a letter from a woman that was upset that I was considering a boycott of the Olympic Games. And then Coach Wooden wrote back to her and said that he had seen firsthand what black Americans have to deal with at times, and he understood why a protest would be something that any black American with common sense might want to consider. He got that. I have the letter, and, you know, I printed it, and it's published.
How did you come into possession of that letter that Wooden had written in response to the woman who wrote him?
Coach Wooden gave it to me. He had saved it, and he said that he thought that I should have it. It's one of my prized possessions, you know, because it's written in his hand.
As a very large black man and an astonishingly successful player in hostile arenas, Kareem was often the target of abuse. From time to time, John Wooden witnessed it. He tried to reinforce the idea that Kareem should try to refrain from judging everybody on the basis of the actions of those who insulted him. But Kareem didn't realize how deeply some of those incidents had affected his coach. As Kareem recalled, "It wasn't until years later that I found out that because of me, he had begun to question his own belief in the innate goodness of people." When Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's mother died in 1997, he and John Wooden talked at length, as they had when John Wooden's wife passed away in 1985. And when Wooden emerged from the depression into which the death of his wife of half a century had plunged him, it was Kareem he called to say, "I found my sense of purpose again." It must have felt like particularly good news. Certainly John Wooden, who died in 2010 at the age of 99, had a lot to do with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's ongoing discovery of his own sense of purpose as a teammate and a man.
And I'm so thankful. You know, I learned from this man from day one until the day he passed. And since he has passed, I'm still learning from my experiences with him. He was an incredible human being.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's most recent book is Coach Wooden and Me, Our 50-Year Friendship on and Off the Court. You can find a link to it at onlyagame.org. Ever been frustrated by the ponderous ends of basketball games? One Mensa member is trying to help.
My highest hope for this idea is that it is adopted and one day I'm being inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame.
This guy's been spending 10 years in this concept, and he's a genius.
The story of basketball's Elam ending, that's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Thanks to TedK49, who left us the following review on iTunes. If you want a sports podcast with a fresh, smart, and insightful view on sports and its unlikely heroes, listen to Only a Game. After all, where else can you hear a story about how a cappuccino machine may have cost the Panthers a Super Bowl ring? Thanks, TedK49. Wait till you hear our upcoming story about how the inability to secure a proper iced half-calf sugar-free cinnamon soy latte cost the 1998 Utah Jazz the NBA title. Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Baylor University's football program is back in the news for all the wrong reasons. That's where we're going to start on this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are Mike Pesca, he's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and Julie DeCaro, a host at Chicago's 670 The Score. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having us.
Julie, please begin for us.
Well, a new Title IX lawsuit was filed against Baylor this week. This is the seventh Title IX case filed against the school. This one alleges that 8 football players took turns raping Jane Doe after she was drugged by the players. It also alleges a lot of things we haven't heard before, like that gang rapes were used as bonding experiences by the players, particularly to haze freshman players. It also alleges there's a 21-second video of 2 students being gang raped by players that was circulated by the team. It also alleges systemic harassment of the victims by the players, that there was a dog fighting ring going on between the players in which dogs were injured severely. And it also has some pretty disheartening responses from Art Briles. For example, when this woman apparently reported being gang raped by players, head coach Art Briles reportedly said, "Those are bad dudes. Why is she hanging around with those guys?" There have now been 17 victims to date who have come forward accusing 19 players of rape. Another lawsuit alleges that there were 52 acts of rape by 31 players. 2 players so far have been convicted of sexual assault. 2 are awaiting trial. 2 more have been indicted on charges of a gang rape in 2013. So I guess the question is, if the NCAA is not going to give the death penalty to a program like Baylor, what is the point and purpose of having the death penalty at all?
I think that the death penalty, when they gave it to SMU, which is the time it was administered, it was seen as an overreaction, too much punishment, because the NCAA is not in the business of not having teams play football. They want teams to play football. It's just that they have toothless enforcement mechanisms. I just can't believe that Baylor, and I'm not calling them hypocrites, but they're a very religious school that did not allow dancing until about 20 years ago. Look at thyself. Look at thyself, Baylor. Is football so important and so fundamental to who you are and what you do that this isn't absolutely shameful? I know the team's getting better than it used to be, but my God, I would think so many students and faculty and people who believe in the Baylor mission would literally say, my God.
I have to agree with you, Mike. It's one thing to say, well, the NCAA should shut the program down. I certainly think the NCAA should, for the safety of all concerned. But Baylor should shut the program down. And that's so obvious that it seems to me remarkable that it hasn't already happened.
Speaking of SMU, which Mike brought up, you know, that was over a slush fund. A slush fund for players. This, we're talking about gang rapes and dogfighting rings. You know, and one of the things that this complaint does very well is it documents exactly how much money was coming in because of the football team and because they were winning and how much alumni donations were up and how much the boosters were bringing in. So, you know, it just seems to be the tale as old as time that money matters more than people when it comes to sports.
And could I just point out a horrifying fact? One of the plaintiffs in this case is known as Elizabeth Doe because they ran out of Jane Does. There were so many Jane Does, Jane Doe 1, 9, 10, that they had to get a new name. This is how deep it goes.
I'm going to turn to a far, far less significant topic. The Celtics have the number one pick in the upcoming NBA draft via a deal that Boston made several years ago with the Nets. So the Nets got two old players, albeit Hall of Famers, Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce. The Celtics got future picks, among them, as it turns out, the number one pick this time around. Probably not the worst trade ever, because who knows how many Nets fans bought tickets to see Garnett and Pierce play in their new building. But I'm open to suggestions for trades with results as lopsided as this one has turned out to be, Mike.
Well, let's go back to the new building. Remember, it wasn't even so much to get people to see the Nets in the new building. It was to build a new building so that the businesses around the building, the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, would benefit the owner of the Nets, who really only cared about building the Target and the Best Buy. I know, I live three blocks from there. And the Nets' Russian owner was very happy to leverage the future of his franchise. And by the way, if we're investigating Putin connections, I say we look into the Nets. I don't know if you need a special prosecutor or special counsel, but if LeVar Ball or Foles goes to the Celtics number one, maybe there'll be a clamor to get one.
See, I thought this was going to be kind of a frivolous topic, and you've taken it into all sorts of intriguing territory. Julie, where are you going to go with this?
Well, you know, I sort of went outside the NBA, and when I think of the worst trades ever, I cannot help but think of Herschel Walker to the Vikings. The Cowboys got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and about a million picks from Minnesota, and then Herschel Walker plays for about 2 years for the Vikings, never rushes for 1,000 yards again, and then quits to go join the U.S. bobsled team.
Okay, well, I think that's probably a viable candidate. Mike, I'm going to pass this over to you now. I think I should, for doing that, I should get an assist, and be assured I do want to be credited with an assist. That okay with you?
The assist is fine, and you should be credited to being part of your way onto the triple-double. But I was thinking about stats because, you know, the actual humans are off-putting to me, and I like numbers. So the triple-double is not a horrible statistic. But when you really think about what the triple-double is, it's a disparate bunch of stats. Every point is a point. Some assists is just dishing it to a guy right under the hoop. But some assists are passing it to a guy who dribbles twice, makes a shake-and-bake move, and does all the work himself. And then you have rebounds, which are both an offensive and defensive stat. So it's kind of a hodgepodge. It's just that stats, as much as I love them, sometimes confuse and befuddle us. And that brings me to baseball and the stat of the save. I have no ill will towards the man, a sports writer who invented the save, but the save is a dumb, dumb statistic. And paying relief pitchers as the last one in the game for earning saves, the fact that there's a monetary value to this dumb statistic, warps the game. It warps our perception of the game. It warps payroll. Luckily, some people are rethinking the save in a way much more complicated than just who was the last guy in who struck the other guy out, but actually much more accurate.
Julie, may I say, save us?
I'll try. I actually feel the same way about wins in baseball as Mike does about saves. I think it's just an absolutely useless stat. that pretty much measures what the team is doing around someone. But the stat that really grinds my gears in basketball is player efficiency rating, PER, which has sort of become the catch-all for how good a player is. And my problem with it is that it doesn't incorporate any reliable defensive stats. So two-way players get punished and ranked lower than guys who focus solely on offense and don't really play defense.
Every time I hear a discussion like this, I'm reminded of the great Willie Mays quote. Somebody pointed out to Willie Mays that a player who came along well after Willie had retired had gotten 40 home runs and 40 stolen bases in the same year. And he said, you know, Willie, you did that one year. And Willie Mays said, gee, if I'd known it was such a big deal, I would have done it every year. It wouldn't have been that hard to do. The baseball, I've given up. I don't understand baseball statistics anymore, and it seems to me you need higher math to even figure out what those Sabre people are talking about. And I realize I sound like I'm about to say get off my lawn, and I can't help it. That's where I am on that one. But, Mike, do you feel you've made some converts here, or do you still have work to do?
Well, if Julie doesn't like the win and I don't like the save, I leave the hold to you, Bill. Defend the hold. It's the only other. It's actually worse than the other two. It's just like a guy who was in the game who didn't blow it. Great.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, could be applied to all manner of professions. He's been working a long time and he hasn't been fired. Give him an award. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Julie DeCaro from Chicago's 670 The Score and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thank you, both of you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Bill.
You ever had an idea that you just couldn't get out of your head? Maybe nobody else gets it yet, but you're sure that it's brilliant. Our next story is about a guy who's been committed to an idea like that for the past decade. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
There are two things you need to know about Nick Elam. He's really smart. He's a member of Mensa. And he really cares about sports. Back in 2003, when Elam was an undergrad at the University of Dayton, he needed a summer job. Instead of bagging groceries or delivering pizzas, he applied to join the grounds crew for the local minor league club, the Dayton Dragons.
They called me in for an interview, but really it was just kind of a tour. I basically just had the job and did that for 3 years and loved it. But then I thought, you know what, I might be ready for the big leagues at this point.
So Nick Elam called the head groundskeeper for the Cincinnati Reds. Elam's now in his 12th season with the club.
There's a lot of very skilled and knowledgeable people on the Reds grounds crew. I'm not one of them. If you were to rank us by our groundskeeping skills, I'm not sure I'd be in the top 20, but I've got spunk, and so that's what I'm there for.
You might wonder why a guy in a high IQ society still spends 50 nights a year dragging around bags of dirt or pulling a tarp over a baseball field.
It's just exciting to play a very small part in the experience of the game.
Elam doesn't devote all his time to grooming baseball diamonds. He works as a middle school principal. He just completed a PhD in educational leadership. And he's trying to change basketball.
To be honest, my highest hope for this idea is that it is adopted at every level of play and that it will be remembered where one day I'm being inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts.
But let's start at the beginning.
This has become a physical battle of attrition.
It's 2004. Nick Elam's promising groundskeeping career has just begun. And on a Sunday in late March, he and his housemates are sitting together on the mismatched furniture in their cramped living room watching the NCAA basketball tournament. There's a tight game between Duke and Xavier. With less than 3 minutes to play, Duke takes a three-point lead. Then the game starts to slow down.
A little clock usage now. Some heady people, particularly Duhon, at the helm.
In case you missed that, the announcer's praising Duke's point guard for dribbling the ball 35 feet from the basket, trying to waste time. Eventually, Xavier had to resort to this.
Here's the ball to Deng, and he's fouled by Sato.
Maybe you know how this plays out. The trailing team fouls on purpose to stop the clock. The strategy doesn't work. Duke still wins after everyone spends a couple minutes watching tall guys shoot free throws. The games on this particular Sunday weren't especially ugly, but they bothered Elam and his friends.
And now, during the most important part of the game, what should be the most exciting part of the game, it's just ugly basketball, but also it's an ineffective strategy to try to come back, but it's still their best option. So we were just talking about how weird that is and thinking there's got to be a way to compel teams to play by the spirit of the rules.
They batted around some ideas. Maybe the penalties should be harsher for deliberate fouls, or maybe play the games without a clock. First team to, say, 75 points wins. But that wouldn't work. Some games would end in an hour, others could take 4 hours. And that's where the conversation ended. But privately, Elam kept thinking about the problem. Finally, in 2013, he settled on an idea he really liked. With less than 4 minutes to go, the clock shuts off. Then, take the leading team's score and add 7 points to it. That becomes the target score. First team to reach that total wins. For example, say it's 66-60 with just under 4 minutes left. You take the leading team score, 66, and add 7. The clock would shut off for the rest of the game, and the first team to reach 73 points wins. The trailing team wouldn't have to worry about running out of time, so they wouldn't need to foul on purpose.
I think it's actually less gimmicky than what we see now at the end of games. It's an idea where you're going to ultimately play a basketball game to a point total. And that's how most of us learn to play the game, playing on the playground to a certain point total.
Elam called it the hybrid duration format, and he was convinced it was the solution. But first, he figured, he had to persuade people there really was a problem. So in 2013, he began his own study. He recorded every NBA game on national TV and every college basketball game on ESPNU and in the NCAA tournament. And every week, he spent his free hours watching the final few minutes of all those games while entering data into an Excel spreadsheet. A few years and a couple thousand games later, the results were striking. The fouling strategy was successful less than 1% of the time.
I realized, yeah, the problem is more common and more striking than what I had initially thought. That's when I really started to believe in the necessity of the idea, not just the soundness of it.
Elam put together a PowerPoint presentation titled Time's Up for Basketball's Game Clock, and he emailed it to almost anybody he could find connected to basketball. NBA execs, WNBA owners, international leagues, all the way down to local rec leagues.
I thought, well, maybe, you know, they've got nothing to lose, I guess. I didn't even get any responses from them, positive or negative.
Some people did write back, and some said it was an interesting idea. But nobody actually wanted to try it out. Elam didn't stop sending emails.
If I didn't believe in the idea, if I didn't think somebody was going to embrace it, I would have given up on this a long time ago. I thought at some point somebody's going to give this a shot.
And that brings us to a guy named Jonathan Mugar.
I'm a creator, founder, and CEO of the basketball tournament.
Mugar is a former Division III basketball player who went to work in Hollywood. In 2011, he got the idea for a basketball tournament with a large cash prize. Anyone, your average Joe or an NBA player, could enter a team. He spent 3 years planning and raising money. In 2014, the first edition of the basketball tournament was scheduled to take place, with a grand prize of $500,000. Before the first tournament, what was like the biggest event you had ever put on?
Put on? I mean, for where I was solely responsible for it, probably nothing.
And yet, the first edition of the basketball tournament was a success. Former Division I and NBA players entered. ESPN streamed the championship game online. And over the past couple years, the tournament has gotten bigger. In 2015, the prize grew to $1 million, and ESPN broadcast games on national TV. Mugar hoped there would be buzzer beaters and exciting finishes, but sure enough, many games ended with fouls and free throws.
Those were so painful to go through. And I remember going over to our basketball operations people like, we got to do something about this. This is terrible.
Could they say anything to make you feel better?
No. It's like, you know, I say it happens. That's what happens in basketball. There's no answer.
At least that's what John Mugar thought. Last August, he got an email from some guy in Ohio with a 67-page PowerPoint presentation. It was, of course, Nick Elam's proposal. Mugar liked what he read, and the more he learned about Elam's backstory, the more he was convinced he should trust the Mensa member / groundskeeper / middle school principal.
It's unbelievable. This guy's been spending 10 years in this concept, and he's a genius.
So last March, Mugar decided that some of the games for the upcoming 2017 edition of the basketball tournament would be played with the new ending.
But Mugar did want to tweak one of Elam's ideas. The name, the hybrid duration format, wasn't going to work. In late March, Elam got an email from Mugar. It said,
"Hey, we'd like to name this the Elam ending. What do you think about that?" And I replied, "I think that's awesome." So I do remember that moment.
So more than a decade after Nick Elam started thinking about changing basketball, the first games with the Elam ending will be played on June 17th and 18th in Philadelphia. Nick Elam plans to be there, clipboard in hand, taking notes. Maybe you should tune in too. Could be a historic moment for basketball. And at the very least, the games won't drag on. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
Ahead on Only a Game, the sudden and puzzling end of Rick Ankiel's once promising pitching career.
The thing, the yips, the monster, whatever you want to name it, you lose your ability to do something that you've done your whole life without the explanation of why.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, defeating bullies in a refugee camp via the banana ball. But now it's time for my conversation about this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Let us start with the NBA. Have you seen anything to suggest that we won't be watching the Cavaliers play the Warriors for the championship again?
Absolutely not, no. The very best we can expect is a couple of decent games. But these two teams, the Cavs and the Warriors, are clearly the best teams in the league.
In Game 1 of the Western Conference Finals, Zazu Pachulia of the Warriors was involved in a play that injured the Spurs' Kawhi Leonard. This inspired Spurs fan Juan Vasquez to file a lawsuit on behalf of Spurs season ticket holders, citing a loss in quality of competition. A judge dismissed this lawsuit. That can't have surprised you, counselor.
No, I mean, as I say, I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on Only a Game. This is a meritless lawsuit.
Nice try, though.
Wonderful try. I mean, I don't know. What did he expect to win in this lawsuit? Did he expect, the Warriors would have to play with four guys?
Possibly a miraculous cure. I don't know.
Seriously, I mean, I presume Kawhi Leonard is well insured. He can pay for his own hospital stay and whatever therapy he needs. I think, you know, and even, by the way, even if he were to win and the Warriors were forced to play with four guys, they'd still beat the Spurs.
Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, said this week that once it became clear that his team would not make the playoffs,
splash!
Quote, "We did everything possible to lose games." That's a quote, I'm telling you. If you're a Dallas fan and you've been paying between $500 and $15,000 for a season ticket, how does this strike you?
If you're paying $15,000 for a ticket to an NBA game and you can't figure out on your own that the team is tanking, you shouldn't be allowed to handle your own money.
Kevin Cash, he was a backup catcher for the Red Sox 10 years ago when Terry Francona managed in Boston. Now Francona manages in Cleveland. Cash manages in Tampa Bay. When the Rays recently traveled to Cleveland, Francona arranged to have the electronic scoreboard post the following message: "How bad is Kevin Cash at the plate?" And under that line, the board showed Cash's 183 batting average and some other equally unimpressive statistics. Funny or cruel, you decide.
I think it's funny, and I think Cash took it that way, and good for him. And Terry Francona is a wonderful presence in the game.
Gisele Bündchen, who probably knows her husband Tom Brady pretty well, says he has a history of concussions, and in fact he had one last season, and the Patriots' records don't show that, and neither do the records of the National Football League. Does this point to, what a silly question, a problem with the league's concussion protocol?
Yes, indeed. It's only, I mean, if it's not being applied to the signature player and maybe the greatest player at the most important position of all time, then what good is the protocol? You know, Tom's a stubborn guy. Tom's probably one of those guys who has to be protected from his own instincts.
I'm sure you're right, but I'm equally sure that the National Football League is full of people who fall into that category.
Yes, but he's the face of the league right now. This is a very important thing. And plus, I know the guy, I know his family, I like them all, and I don't want to see him, you know, he's cognitively damaged when he's 50.
So what can the National Football League do?
Well, they can pay attention to Gisele Bündchen is what they can do.
The Chargers and Rams were set to play their football games in a new, allegedly state-of-the-art stadium on the site of the old Hollywood Park racetrack. This was supposed to happen in 2019. Recent record-setting rains in Los Angeles will delay completion by a year. I guess even the mighty NFL is rendered powerless by the weather.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is all this means is the cost overruns will be spectacular, and somebody will be paying a lot for it, and I suspect it won't be the owners of those two teams.
Can we blame El Nino for this? Because that would be Spanish for the Nino, which I think really means El Disappointed Season Ticket Holder.
El Grifto.
Yes. Next month, we'll see the unveiling of a new professional flag football league, Charlie. Actually, the eight-team league won't begin to play until 2018, but Michael Vick is going to quarterback a team in a kind of a test run, 7-on-7 game, regulation, 100-yard football field. You like this idea?
Hey, I think it might actually be a lot of fun. I mean, I'm one of the real proponents of arena football, which is completely weird.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think flag football is that much of a stretch. Plus, it's safe.
It would still be athletes being athletes.
It would, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Finally, Charlie, Duke University recently listed a new full-time position, Athletic Facilities Game Operations and Championships Assistant. Sounds like a big job. Salary is about $7.2 million less than Coach K makes at Duke because the salary is zero. According to the original description, the lucky employee would have a unique opportunity to gain hands-on experience in the daily operations of a Division I athletic department. Duke recently pulled this listing. I don't suppose they were embarrassed.
Yes, it also has a unique opportunity to eat ramen noodles three meals a day for a month, for 2.5 years.
For 11 months at least. I know.
Who's the marketing guy who put that one up saying, oh, people will jump for this, you know, maybe we'll give them a free hat?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Subscribe to Only a Game on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, share your thoughts about our show in a review. We want to know what you think, and your review will help other people find our show. Have you ever wondered what it is? As in, that pitcher really has it tonight, or that pitcher had it over a spectacular season, or even a long, successful career. We may never know exactly how to define it, but maybe the story of a once very promising major league pitcher can help us understand it just a little bit better. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Rick Ankiel is not a doctor, but if you ask him what happened to his once promising major league pitching career, he'll offer a diagnosis.
The thing, the yips, the monster, whatever you want to name it, you lose your ability to do something that you've done your whole life without the explanation of why.
20 years ago, some were calling Ankiel the next Sandy Koufax, the next Bob Gibson, a once-in-a-generation pitcher. What he was at the time was a talented 17-year-old who had used baseball to escape from a difficult home.
I grew up in Fort Pierce, Florida. Family life at times was good and at times was bad. My father was an alcoholic and two-bit criminal, abused drugs, and there were times where he'd disappear for a few days, you know. He'd start drinking and then he was gone. But when he would come home, you heard the car door slam. You knew it was time to make sure you stayed out of the way, and, you know, it makes it hard.
Ankiel's father beat his mother and sometimes turned his wrath on his children. Throughout the hard times, Ankiel played sports, lots of them, with his brother and neighborhood friends, and sometimes even with his father, whose verbal abuse undercut his son's confidence for a time. The young Ankiel loved baseball, and it came very easily to him. In high school, he had a 94-mile-per-hour fastball. He struck out 162 batters in 74 innings his senior year and posted an ERA of 0.47. He had found a way to feel good about himself.
Oh, it's the best feeling in the world. I mean, you're out there and you control the entire game. You know, in those moments, you feel like it's your destiny and you were meant to be there and put on this earth for that reason.
After high school, Ankiel entered the 1997 Major League Draft and was chosen in the second round by the St. Louis Cardinals. He rose quickly through the minors. On August 23rd, 1999, he made his first major league start. He was 20.
I remember the first hitter I faced, which was Rondell White, and I struck him out. And after that first strikeout, it was another one of those reminders of, like, I'm supposed to be here, and this is how it was supposed to happen.
Ankiel went 11-7 in the 2000 season. The Cardinals made the playoffs and faced Atlanta in the first round. Manager Tony La Russa named Ankiel as the Game 1 starter. Ankiel was confident his success in the regular season would carry over.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, I thought it was going to go better. You know, I was more worried about getting a base hit off of Greg Maddux than I was pitching, because I thought pitching would just take care of itself.
It always had for Rick Ankiel. Why wouldn't it in his postseason debut?
Everything was great. I remember walking from the bullpen to the dugout. We were the home team, and I was ready. I felt like this was my time to show the world who I was.
The Cardinals jumped out to an early lead, and Ankiel cruised through the first two innings. He took the mound in the third inning with a 6-0 lead. Then the thing Ankiel talked about came calling.
Drew Jones in the dirt, back to the screen. And over to second base goes Greg Maddux on a wild pitch.
And I threw a fastball in that cut. It really wasn't that bad of a pitch, but the catcher missed it. And I thought to myself, man, I just threw a wild pitch on national TV.
Having established a shaky foothold in Rick Ankiel's psyche, the thing took over.
Another wild pitch over the head of Hernandez and back to the backstop.
I'm trying to use all my keys that would get me back on track. Keep your weight back, lead with your hip, keep your elbow up, all these things, and everything that had always worked for me was not working in that moment.
Wow, to the screen again, it hits off the backstop and right back to Hernandez, so Maddux didn't go anywhere. But Andrew Jones goes to second on the third wild pitch of the inning.
So now I'm launching stuff off the back screen against the backstop, and it just continually got worse.
And another wild one. And Maddux will score. It's
and I was so young, I didn't even understand what was going on. You know, it just seems like things start to speed up so fast. The craziest thing is that I knew what I wanted to do, but my body and brain would not allow me to do it.
So there is the fifth wild pitch of the inning.
The last major league pitcher to throw five wild pitches in one inning was Burt Cunningham. That happened on September 15th, 1890. Ankiel was given the hook in the third inning, with St. Louis leading 6-2. The Cardinals hung on to win the game, and Ankiel's teammates did their best to say the things that would help him get his head together for his next postseason start.
A lot of just, hey, stay strong, you know, but I think it's one of those things where they didn't know what to say, and me being as young as I was, I just laughed it off, and I told them and told the media afterwards, hey, this is a mechanical glitch, it'll never happen again, I'll be fine.
But he wasn't. 9 days after his disastrous performance against the Braves, he took the mound to face the New York Mets in the National League Championship Series. He threw two more wild pitches, gave up two runs, and was yanked in the first inning.
That's when it started to settle in, hey, something's not quite right here.
Yes, but what wasn't right? Ankiel didn't know. The Mets eliminated the Cardinals, and Ankiel looked for the answer in the offseason. He met regularly with a sports psychologist. He threw balls at a wall behind his house for several hours each day. He tried to imitate the mechanics of other pitchers. Then he began having nightmares in which he was unable to throw a single strike.
And I'd wake up with my heart beating 100 miles an hour, sweating. That anxiety would carry over into the next day, and now trying to play catch was near impossible.
Ankiel's anxiety carried over to the beginning of the 2001 season, when he faced the Diamondbacks and one of the most feared pitchers in the game.
And I remember that day of the first start, and I was going to start against Randy Johnson. And that day of the game, once I got to the stadium, the anxiety and the nerves that I felt were overwhelming.
Ankiel went to his mentor, Cardinals ace Darryl Kyle, and asked him a question.
Hey, do you think you can go find some alcohol and put it in a water bottle? I was like, I have no chance to go out there and be successful. I don't know what else to do. And he went and got it, and I started sipping on that water bottle, and it worked. And I remember during the third inning feeling like I could feel the anxiety trying to overcome the alcohol. And I just kept sipping on that water bottle, and I did beat Randy Johnson that game. And then the next game, I tried it again. The anxiety overcame the alcohol, and things just started to go south again, and I was throwing balls all over again.
Ankiel lost his second start of the season and was sent to the minors. The next 3 years brought more wild pitches, more anxiety, elbow surgery, and the sudden death of his close friend Daryl Kyle. Ankiel says he battled the best he could, but he finally admitted to himself that in those few minutes on the mound in the 2000 postseason, his psyche had been permanently damaged. In March 2005, he decided to retire.
I went into Tony La Russa's office and said, hey, you know, I can't do this anymore. And I go home, and now I'm at home on the couch, and my agent Scott Boras calls me, and he says to me, are you ready to go play? I said, go play what? He said, baseball. I'm like, what are you talking about? Is nobody listening to me? I just quit. I'm done. I retired. He's like, no, as an outfielder, would you want to try to be an outfielder? I remember saying to him, you know what? I got to think about this. So I hang up, and finally I let myself visualize making it back to the big leagues as an outfielder and hitting a home run. And once I felt what that felt like in my mind, I picked up the phone, called Scott Boras, and said, hey, I'm in 100%. Let's do this.
Doing this meant another stint in the Cardinals minor league system, this time as an everyday player. But knee surgery led to a couple more lost seasons. But he stuck with it. On August 9th, 2007, Ankiel made his major league debut as an outfielder and full-time hitter.
And in the order, no hits.
Ankiel out to deep right field, has a chance to leave the ballpark. It's gone! A three-run shot for Rick Ankiel back in the major leagues.
Over the next seven seasons, Ankiel held down a major league job and excelled as an outfielder.
Here comes that throw from Ankiel. He got him! Another one! Rick Ankiel with his second outfield assist of the night. Unreal!
Ankiel says it was easier for him to throw a ball to the plate from 300 feet away than it had been to throw strikes from the mound. His arm was no longer under control of the beast, the monster, or the thing.
Driving to the park, knowing that I'm going to be an outfielder today and I don't have to worry about throwing strikes, it was fun. I felt like this giant weight had been lifted off of my shoulders and I could breathe again.
Rick Ankiel batted .228 as an everyday player with six different teams. He retired from baseball after the 2013 season. He seems happy now. Maybe it's because marriage and fatherhood have given him the opportunity to get right what was so wrong when he was a kid. Or maybe it's because, despite his inability to know all the reasons for the implosion of his pitching career, he can now characterize it this way.
As awesome. I mean, I got to live two dreams, and there's not a lot of people who can say that. It's hard enough to make it to the big leagues once, and now I'm the guy who's got to say that I made it twice, and I'm proud of that.
For only a game, I'm Gary Wallach.
Rick Ankiel is a studio analyst for Fox Sports Midwest, and you can learn more about his story in his new book, The Phenomenon, Pressure, the Yips, and the Pitch That Changed My Life. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from basketball tournament organizer Jonathan Mugar, who is apparently considering ways to screen emails from people like basketball reformist Nick Elam.
I should have like an immediate Mensa filter on my email.
Yeah, that'd be pretty smart. It's funny, isn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.